Welcome to Law Subscribe. This is your dedicated news source for all things subscriptions and the law. My name is Matthew Kurbis. I'm the subscription attorney, and I believe subscriptions can help bridge the access to justice gap and incentivize attorneys to modernize and scale their practice like never before. In this episode, I interview Thomas Bowden. Thomas is living proof that a practicing attorney with 40 years of experience can also be innovative when delivering legal services. In fact, he was an early adopter of the subscription model for legal services and has been ditching the billable hours since early in his career. Tom has some great ideas with how he's implementing the model, and I appreciate him coming on the show to share his wisdom with the rest of us. Longtime listeners know I've been releasing videos of my podcast to all of my Substack subscribers. Go to lawsubscribe.com and join the Substack using the form on the homepage. I'm speaking at ABA Tech Show in Chicago this February of 2024, where I'll be presenting on generative AI and the subscription model and podcasting for lawyers. Register for that at techshow.com. Thanks as always to my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, links to both in the show notes, more on them later, and remember to use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED when signing up. It lets them know you found out about them from the podcast, you get 10% off, and it really supports the show. Another way to support the show is to share it with someone you know. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and nothing said is legal, ethical, or financial advice. Without further delay, here's the episode. Thomas Bowden, thank you so much for coming on the podcast Law Subscribed.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I'm excited to do this.
Yeah, it's doing this podcast. I always love discovering not just other attorneys doing it in a similar way to what I'm doing it, but sometimes you just find people cut from the same cloth, which is why I'm so glad that we were introduced to each other, Tom. So we've had a chance to chat, but for my listeners, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Sure. Well, I'm Tom Bowden. I'm an attorney in Richmond, Virginia, where I've practiced for 30-odd years, and before that, I started my professional life in Pennsylvania, which is my home state. Practiced in a boutique firm for about 7 or 8 years before moving to my family to Virginia. I've always been focused on representing entrepreneurs, growing businesses, heavy dose of technology, always been interested in technology in general, and also in technology as applies to the practice of law. And so I've been a student of the application of law and technology for some time, although I can't claim to have any shocking insights that most people don't already have. And I have been a very frequent contributor on various forums, including LinkedIn in particular, to the debate over billable hours versus what are probably poorly described as alternative fees, in the sense of alternative to what? They're just fees, and they're just done a different way. But agreed pricing or value-based pricing, as Ron Baker and Ed Klass call it. And I've been associated with a group called VeriSage for probably more than 10 years. Came to know them through LinkedIn. My good friend John Chisholm in particular reached out to me through LinkedIn, and we became connected, and we've engaged in many debates together on the platform. And we take all comers when it comes to the arguments for and against hourly pricing.
Go ahead. You are in great company here, Tom, with all that background. And also, because I think it's important for my listeners to hear, how long have you been practicing law for?
Well, I'm approaching my 40th anniversary of practicing law. Graduated from the University of Pennsylvania Law School in 1983 and got my JD and MBA at the same time from the Wharton School. Was an undergraduate major in economics. Worked 1 year before going to law school. So I've been at this for a while, and all through law school, really starting with the first summer after my first year of law school, I worked part-time for a law firm in Philadelphia and helped put myself through law school and learn the trade. You know, you only learn so much in reading cases and attending lectures. You really learn how things are done in actual practice. So whereas many of my classmates were into, you know, moot court and mock trials, et cetera, I was, generally speaking, drafting contracts and writing articles of organization, et cetera, even before I graduated. And I had the good fortune to have some really good mentors. And this is what I've been doing with one slight deviation I should describe. I was invited by a client in 1994 to help form a company. And then I basically got recruited to go in-house as general counsel and became more of an executive than a practicing attorney for a few years. And that gig ended with September 11th, 2001. I won't go into the details, but so I returned to the practice full time and kind of had to re-engineer myself, having been a client for a couple of years and returning to the practice from the other side was more of an adjustment than I expected. So that took me a little bit while to sort out. But that episode of being an entrepreneur myself also contributed very greatly to my thinking on how to structure the, you know, the business model of a law practice. Having paid six-figure legal fees to major firms whose names you would recognize instantly and gotten literally zero value gave me, you know, more than an inkling that something was wrong with the business model. And it was shocking sometimes to hear the justifications for both the amount that was billed and why we had to pay it, even though we didn't get any values for it. And, you know, my economics training kicked in and I started to think about that quite a bit, saying, well, how can I model the actual business of billable hours? What is the marginal cost? What is the, you know, what is the microeconomics of this so-called business model? And I came to the conclusion there was really nothing there. And I've since sometimes summarized that argument by saying that time is not a cost, it's a constraint. And there's a difference between a cost and a constraint. So, you know, a cost is something that you consume, you can replace. It has a unit value that is externally determined. Whereas a constraint is like, well, I have this factory and it has three lines of production and they move at a certain speed. And once I hit that, I'm done. I can't produce any more with that factory without building another one. So time is like that. Time is like a river. It flows. You can't stop it. You can't save it up. Maybe you can dam it and save a little in a reservoir, but time doesn't even really work like that. And so the analogy stuck and I started thinking about it more and more. And I'd always had in the back of my mind the notion that legal fees didn't have to be determined by hourly billing. And I came to find out in researching that the hourly billing model is actually fairly recent in the practice of law. I mean, if you think of my practice as being roughly 40 years plus some as a clerk, it really doesn't go back a whole lot farther than that as the dominant business model. It might go 50, 60 years. It really came into full bloom with the Goldberg decision in the Supreme Court, the United States, which was a Virginia case. It was a case where an attorney wanted to offer to do a title search for his client and deviated from the Bar Association published rates. And the Bar Association sued him. Threatened to take his license, you know, it came down hard.
Oh, yeah.
And he went to court and I believe he won. And then it went to the United States Supreme Court and he won there. And the Supreme Court said, seems almost obvious in retrospect, hey, lawyers, you know, you're a guild, you're self-regulating, you got all this history and tradition, but you're no different than any other business. You cannot set prices. You cannot set prices for the industry by collusion. That's an antitrust violation.
Right.
And that, plus the development of mini computers and then ultimately personal computers and you know, cheap processing power and database programs really led to the development of the early billing systems that were instituted first in larger law firms. And then as the technology got more affordable, trickled down to the smaller firms. So that's more than a little bit of background. Maybe that's the whole podcast. I don't know.
No. This is great background because I've brought up that case before, but never in such detail. So I think it's good for the listeners to hear it. And also, you know, I'm so glad that you're doing what you're doing. And we're going to get into like exactly what it is. Link in the show notes to those who skipped ahead in the podcast feed. Timeless Counsel is the law firm, timelesscounsel.com, which, you know, is like a like. Yeah, I feel like my brand subscription attorney is like a cousin of Timeless Counsel, and even your. You know, your tagline is like my tagline is like a cousin to yours because yours is invaluable advice at a pre-agreed price, which I love because mine is a transparent price for legal advice.
Right.
But because you've been doing this for so long, like you, first of all, you've been doing the subscription model in some way for about how long?
Goes back to 2012.
Right. So like over a decade. So you're in that category of few attorneys that I've had on the podcast that have been doing that type of fee arrangement for that long. But in particular, Tom, how I'm thinking about how I'm going to share this episode is you've been practicing law the longest. And some of the most pushback that I get when I'm out there doing the CLEs or I'm doing stuff on social media, that it's the more experienced attorneys who have trepidation about not billing their time. And so that you're doing it, I think, is a shining example that it doesn't matter how long you've been practicing law, it is a great way to practice law is to not be billing yeah. your time. So yeah. so even more background, but I love to hear, you know, that 10, 11, 12 years ago, you know, what got you started? And, you know, you sort of started to talk about, you know, how you it didn't make sense to you that there was no value for all the time that right. you paid when you were the client. So what made you want to stop billing time, start doing, quote, alternative fees? And like, where did you look for resources of how to do it? Or did you just kind of have to build it as you went?
Well, first of all, it's something that I started to experiment with in 2001 or 2002, when the company that I just described in brief disappeared and I came back to practicing full time. I came to a series of law firms. I tried it in more than one. I won't say how many, and said, look, I have some experience that is relevant to this question. I have been a client. I have, you know, been on both sides of this deal. And I can tell you that, you know, there's an opportunity here if you're willing to pursue it. And, you know, without exception, the firm said, well, that's really interesting. We'd like you to do that. You know, come on board, let's try it. But inevitably after the first month, it's like, well, you didn't do any timesheets. And I said, well, yeah, I told you. That's not how I'm going to do things. And they went, well, no, you still have to do your timesheet. So then you realize all of a sudden you've got one foot on the dock and one foot on the boat, and they're mm-hmm. starting to go in different directions. And so there's frequently a desire, or at least a recognition in law firms, that they might want to try doing something different. But the law in general, lawyers in particular, and maybe more so the longer they've been in practice, are creatures of habit and inherently conservative for the most part. And, you know, the way their mentor did it is the way it should be done. Whether their mentor was right or wrong, that's what they learned. They feel comfortable. They're in their comfort zone. They've got their security blanket in the form of a timesheet. Makes them feel like they're worth something, whatever it is. When you try to pull that out from under them, poor analogy, maybe off of them, they get very nervous. And then you get into the whole issue of firm dynamics, where a firm of any size has a billing department. And a billing department, you know, if you're going to charge something other than your hourly rate times the number of hours recorded, you've got to go through the billing department. And, you know, one week you come in and the bill is far greater than the hours you put in. The next week you come in and it's far less. And in both cases, they freak out. Mm-hmm. And they're just not set up to deal with variations from a theme. So to put it mildly, my efforts through a number of law firms to implement that policy were not successful. And in looking back, I realized I was a bit arrogant to think that the new guy coming on board could just like be the agent of change for the entire corporate department or firm or what have you. And I should have anticipated more resistance, and it's nobody's fault but my own. But so when I parted company with the last law firm, I just made a promise to myself, and this was in 2012. I said, you know what? I'm just going to stay solo. I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to sink or swim. If it doesn't work, I tried it without any impediments. I can't blame it on anybody else if it didn't work, but I'm going to give it a try. And I had virtually zero clients. I think one client at that point contacted me after I left that law firm and said, hey, I still want to work with you. And I've built everything since then from scratch. And I've had some interesting conversations with clients when I'm introduced to a client. One client in particular was introduced to me by a banker and a consultant, and they were in a real pickle with a major customer, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars at stake. They were about to go under, and somehow I got recommended to help solve the problem. And I said, you know, I gave my little pitch to the client, and he said, well, okay, well, how do we get started? And I said, well, send me your information. Let me look at it. We'll talk some more and I'll come back to you with a proposal. And he said, well, what's your hourly rate? I said, I don't have one. And he said, well, how do you charge? And I said, well, I'm going to look at the information. I'm going to size up the problem, and we're going to set up some kind of an arrangement that you've agreed to or not. And that's what it'll be. And it won't have anything to do with hourly rates. And he said, well, can't you just bill me by the hour till we get started and you get a sense of things? And I said, no, not going to do that. Because, you know, I'm saying to myself, I'm going to keep my promise to myself. I will never bill another hour.
Right.
And there was this long silence on the other side of the phone call. And he said, okay, what do you want to do? So, you know, I got the information. I looked it over. And what I did was I set up in a sense, a monthly retainer. Now, maybe that's cheating. Maybe that's just billable hours in a big block. But again, it was not a price that was set based on the number of hours. It's like, I'm going to charge you this much for the first month. And, you know, we'll either solve the problem or we won't. And if we have to, we'll go to another month, et cetera. So in a sense, you could argue that it's still got some time element to it. And that's, you know, I think that's reasonable. It's not to say that the time is not a factor at all. But it turned out to be a very good relationship. And I ended up solving their problem and continuing to represent them and taking them through several processes of getting ready to sell the company and ultimately successfully helping them sell the company again for an agreed flat fee.
Right.
So that was a real soup to nuts experience that convinced me as much as anything that I had a good model. And then all along, I've been representing clients of various sizes and charging a flat monthly fee that covers a scope of work that's predefined. And I have a standard engagement letter with a standard scope. And then I have a list of things that can be out of scope that can be added in, and we negotiate. I propose a price. They say, well, that's good, but can you also do X? Or I don't need A, B, and C. Can you do X, Y, Z instead? And we come up with a custom scope and a custom price. And then we go from there. And under ethical rules, of course, you can have a contract with a client, but you can't hold them to any particular length of time. And so I always reemphasize to them, look, if this doesn't work, if this is not the right number for you at any point in time, either because your situation has changed for the better or for the worse, either of us can come to the other and talk about it. And you are never obligated, you know, more than the month you're already in. And I think that gives people a lot of confidence that they're not signing up to some, you know, roller coaster of who knows what's coming down the pike and how do I get out if I don't want to do it. And so it's worked well. I've had clients come and go. I've had clients say, you know what, we're just not that busy right now. And I think you got us in pretty good shape. So let's just terminate. We'll come to you if we need you for a specific project. And then some of them have come back and said, You know what, it's going to be busy for a while. Let's get back on the program. So it's a mixture of subscription law and project-based or success-based fees. Mm-hmm. And I am happy to say, I used to be able to say that I had absolutely zero uncollected receivables. There's one client that, for reasons I still don't understand, just went dark and didn't pay me a small bill. Happens. But I mean, in the amount of fees, it's a fraction of a percent.
Right.
And, you know, when you compare that to the experience of most firms who bill by the hour, you send the bill out, brush fingers, you know, you pray to whatever God you worship and hopefully they don't come back and blow up and, you know, at you and tell you you're crazy or you're whatever. Maybe they just pay it, but it's kind of rare that bills are not negotiated. The counterexample to that is probably in one of the firms I worked for was an insurance defense firm, and they had a corporate section as well that I was in, but the insurance defense people lived and died by the terms of their engagement agreements, which were 10, 20, 30 pages long. And so they had a screening process. And if your bill didn't get kicked out of the screening process, which was done by a computer to see if you ever had more than two people in a meeting or more than this much time for a certain, you know, if you violated any of those rules, got kicked out, revised the bills, resubmit it another 30 to 60 days in the cycle, right? But if you got the bill right and didn't violate any of their prohibitions, then it would go through and be paid promptly. So, you know, that's the only scenario in which I've seen billable hours be relatively friction free. And yet you think about all the effort that goes in on the front end, prepare the bill and make sure on the law firm end that we're not doing anything we're not supposed to do. And then you think of the effort and time and expense of developing a computer program to analyze the bill to see if it violated any of these pre-agreed rules. All of that is a total waste of time and no economic benefit whatsoever.
Yeah, I'm so glad to hear you say the piece about the not locking people into a long-term contract, because I've certainly had some attorneys on the show that do that. They do like sometimes 6 months or a year-long type contract, and it's complicated with certain things like trademarks where they kind of just have a flat fee that they break up over several months. And once the flat fee is paid, then they register.
Well, that's different. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. So it context matters, but I found very early on that making it super easy to unsubscribe and resubscribe makes people want to come back to you. And it does put, it shows them that you're confident that the skills you're going to deliver are good. And at Tech Show, when I gave this presentation, there was some hesitation from some people in the audience that were like, well, what happens if they come and they get all their legal services that they want and then they leave after the month is over? I was like, well, that's why you got to price your services correctly. And you got to make it really easy to come back to, because chances are that's not the only legal needs they're going to have ever, that client. So if you do a good job, then they'll come back
or
not leave in the first place. It depends. Like every client, business, individual, it sort of depends on the context. But I've also had clients who think that, because my entry level price is $20 a month, which I know is like exceedingly low, but I'm targeting a very specific market with that. But I've had clients who are like, well, they just assume to get that price, they're going to be locked into a year-long contract. So even on the client side, they can't believe it when it's month to month. That I just had to put that on the first page of my website, because that was a question I kept getting from potential clients. Well, how long do I have to stay subscribed? No, it's a month to month subscription. And so,
well, I'm gonna date myself. It reminds me of the commercials that were all over television around the time of MCI and all of these, entrance to the long distance market, where the price model was changing from by the minute, with, expensive at certain times and cheaper at other times. And if you call at 3 a.m. on a Saturday afternoon, Saturday morning, you can get long distance for only 39 cents. And they had celebrities. I'm trying to think who they were, but they were pounding into these people's heads. No, it's 10 cents a minute. Any day, all time, 24 hours.
Oh, but what about Christmas?
10 cents a minute, no matter when. And they just had to keep beating these people over the head, because they couldn't get the paradigm out of their head that, quote, long distance, quote, quote, is expensive. Mm-hmm. And all of that just, out the window. And now, of course, long distance is unmetered, essentially. You pay a subscription price and you get to use it as much as you want. And there's effectively no limit. So, and then the other question that comes...
Oh, so just really quick, because I want to give you some more stuff for your answers, is in my experience, it's been the clients who have hired lawyers before that think there's going to be a long-term contract. For people who have never hired a lawyer before, but they've subscribed to a lot of other services that are month to month, they're just like, well, of course, that's how you do it, right? So like, again, it's like, what market are you serving? And their experience with it could be totally different.
Right. That's true. But it's, the confidence factor is one thing, which is, I'm confident you'll stay as long as you need to, because I believe I'm good at what I do. And you know what, if you leave and you go to somebody else, that's probably my fault. So I'm fine with that. It keeps me engaged, keeps me focused on making sure that I provide value. And as I said, it's worked very well. I can't, that if you read all of Ron Baker's books and subscribe to a lot of the different sources in and around that universe, you will hear all kinds of theories about how to get the best price and how to offer alternatives so that, you can pick from, three options. And that's the best way to make sure that somebody picks at least one option, as opposed to just putting one out there that they either take it or leave it. Mm-hmm. I've tried to experiment with that. I have to admit, I'm not very good at it. I tend to think of, well, this is an X dollar a month client, and that's what I'm going to propose. And they can, and if they want to push back and tell me it's a little high, then I'll listen. And if they say yes too quickly, maybe next time I'll increase it. Because, trying to find that demand curve, and you don't have a lot of data. So in fact, I have thought of starting a business, a service for attorneys that would accumulate data around this kind of a practice, so that you could make an educated guess as to what you should propose. And that ultimately it could grow into a large service that would accumulate, terabytes of data on different types of transactions and services, et cetera, that you'd be able to get at least the starting point. Because the biggest thing that people are afraid of is, how do I get that price? Where do I come up with it? I mean, don't I have to look at how many hours I think it'll take me and back into it? And the answer is no, you don't. But but your habits will tell you that you do. And one thing that is really helpful is if you have multiple people in a firm, then you can talk about it and collaborate and get the input from others. I've had to stay, you know, pretty much on my own. I will say, though, that I had a very interesting wake-up call early in this experience as Timeless Counsel. I had a client that proposed they wanted to retain me to do a certain project. And I was just struggling for days before I was scheduled to produce a proposal. And I was trying to decide if it was going to be X dollars or 1.5 times X or maybe even 2X, you know, where, what am I going to do? And I decided on 2X, right? I won't mention the number. And I got on the phone call to present the proposal and I said, so here's what I'll do. And this is the scope of work and I'll have it done by a certain date. And I'm going to charge you. I propose to charge you. And I was like, a little voice in the back of my head said, pay 4X. I threw out 4X. He said, great, done. I went, wow, that's interesting. Here I was beating myself up, trying to get from 1 to 2. And he took 4 like that. So a few months later, I was having dinner with John Chisholm, who was in the United States for a conference all the way from Australia. And we got together for dinner. And I said, hey, John, let me just do this little experiment for you. I described project. I described the client. And I said, what would you have proposed as a price? I won't tell you what I proposed. I just want to hear it straight from you. And he said, 8X. And I went, oh my God, I left half the money on the table. So it's really hard until you, but that's the first one. Okay.
Yeah.
After that, you start to get a better sense. And you also realize that, okay, if somebody's willing to pay you X for a monthly subscription amount and you have the same scope, if you propose X or somewhere in and around there to another client and they don't want to do it, then maybe you don't want them as the client. Mm-hmm. Because somebody else has already established that you're worth that much money or more. Otherwise, they would not have signed up. So why should you bargain yourself down to less than that, assuming that you have enough prospects coming along? Now, maybe you want to take it because it's an interesting client, or maybe you need the money or whatever, but you know, it's a process, but there's a steep learning curve. You get there pretty quickly.
Yeah. When I went solo, I pivoted from mostly litigation to a transactional-only practice. I did not have a database of documents to automate. That's why a business and employment legal document database and automation tool like 650 is super useful. I can rely on the quality of the documents in 650's database since they're putting excellent legal minds to work curating and updating their documents and automations over time. When you're not billing by the hour, outsourcing and efficiency matters, and 650 can help you scale your practice to get high-quality documents drafted in less time. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at 650.com and when being onboarded to get 10% off. If you're not a business and employment attorney or you have your own documents that you'd prefer to use, then my next sponsor, Gavel, is the automation tool for you. Gavel allows you to build shareable, client-facing workflow and document automations. In other words, Gavel helps you create a legal practice where attorneys can monetize the value they bring clients in productized form and scale via subscriptions and flat fees. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at gavel.io to get 10% off an annual subscription. There's no one right way to automate and scale your practice, but with one or both of my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, you can take your subscription law firm to the next level. Links to both in the show notes. Now back to the show.
And it, you know, as we discussed, I mean, context absolutely matters with everything that we're talking about today. But one of the reasons why I'm so glad I have you on is even with all the similarities that they are, because, you know, I mean, longtime listeners know I've derived my own algorithm for pricing litigation based on subscription and flat fee. Is that ultimately we have in a way taken a different approach, which is this is something I like briefly mention in my CLE, but I don't really spend too much time on it. I've been spending a little more time on it in the subscription seminar that I've started doing, but is exactly what you're talking about, what you're doing with your practice is like my practice is built around the latent legal market. So I am not trying to do what you just described. I'm trying to see what is the lowest I could charge and still make a profit to bring in business of clients who otherwise never would have hired a lawyer, which is just a totally different approach.
Yeah, it's like the blue ocean strategy.
Exactly, precisely. Yes, I'm taking the blue ocean strategy, but in a way, though, even if your clients are institutional clients who have paid the billable hour before,
your approach with a with an alternative fee to the billable hour is still, in a way, it's like it's an open approach. It's a different approach, but you can, the way that I've said it, and I'm curious to get your feedback on this. The way that I've said it in the CLE is, you can scope a project, think it's going to, and for these are for lawyers who are still thinking in terms of time, which I want to get them completely away from. But it's like, think if this thing's going to take you 10 hours, you know, and you bill $500 an hour, you know, if you double that and break it up in a monthly payment, you know, to your client, because you know something's going to take so many months to do, or even just a value-based project is this is what the project's going to cost, and you 2X it, you'd be surprised that clients, even knowing what they're going to pay, even if it's two times what they maybe would have paid you by the hour, might be happy to pay it because they know exactly what it's going to cost them. So has that,
that's right,
that's been your experience then?
There's a huge value in certainty. And I do everything I can to avoid coming back to a client and saying, hey, I goofed. This is much more involved. I need more money. I will take it on the chin more often than not and not raise my hand, but I have the option to, and they have the option to do as well in either direction. And it just hasn't been a big thing. And you know, the other thing kind of related to that, that you touched on earlier, but maybe in a little more detail here. One of the reactions I get when I discuss it with other attorneys or when I get into it on LinkedIn as well, how do you know if you give this client, you know, the all you can eat plan, they're going to call you and keep you on the phone all day long? It's like, you know what? Most business owners have better things to do than talk to their attorneys. And there's still enough resistance to doing that, that, you know, they don't walk in the morning and say, gosh, I could talk to Tom Bowden all day for free because I've already paid the bill. I mean, no, they're not going to do that. They call you when they have a problem, and they still have a problem sometimes calling soon enough. And I say right in the, I sort of have a pitch built into my proposal, which is part of my fee agreement. You know, I want you to call me early. I want you to call me. It's like when you're driving your car, you start to hear that little ticking noise, right? Go to the shop, get it checked out. It might be nothing, but it's not going to get better. It's not going to fix itself. So when you have that inkling that there's a possible legal problem brewing, come to me early. That's why it's prepaid. That's why it's, you know, you're already on the plan so that you don't have to worry about that. And, you know, we can stop this before it metastasizes into something that's existential for your company.
So, something that I've been thinking about doing with my like higher ticket subscribers, and I'm curious to know if you've ever tried something like this or you're thinking about this, is, well, first of all, my higher ticket subscribers tend to call me because like they're paying more money and they're going to use me because they're paying more money. But
right, sure.
But there can be a few weeks that maybe go by and like I haven't heard from them. So like I might reach out, hey, what could I help you with? But I almost wonder if it's worth it. And I think I've had at least two attorneys on the podcast who have said that they do some version of this, which is like, we're going to have a standing 30-minute meeting once a month.
Yes.
Like the first Monday or first Tuesday of the month or something like that. So like, tell me about your experience.
Well, I had one just before I got on the call with you, as a matter of fact. And I do it for that reason, because I mean, I genuinely want to provide value. This is not, you know, you could look at this and say, well, if you set the price low enough, you could get a huge number of clients and almost none of them will ever call you. And it's more almost like an insurance scheme, right?
Gym membership. It's the gym membership
model. Yeah, it's the gym membership. And that's not my intention. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. But my intention is because of my, and this goes way back to that first law firm I was in where I virtually almost became part of the client at one point when they were doing a lot of acquisitions. I like to be involved. I like to be engaged. I like to be, you know, part of the company, even if I'm not fully engaged as an employee, because I feel like I have a contribution to make. And if I'm not making that contribution, I feel like I'm not earning my fee. So I will reach out. I should probably be even more proactive than I am, but I have on many occasions set up standing calls for just that reason, because it's either we've got some things that are in progress and we just need to make sure we touch base frequently, or because I want to continue to pull work out of the client and do more for them so that I justify the fee, because I want to have that continuing relationship that, you know, part of my model is built around the notion that if I'm representing an entrepreneurial situation, a firm that's growing, you know, an entrepreneur that's either raising money or doing acquisitions or looking to be acquired, et cetera. I want to help them prepare for that. And I want to be around when it happens because I want to represent them in that sale or in that acquisition or in that financing. And so that's one of the reasons to stay more actively involved. And I'm always looking for ways to do that. One of the things that I've been trying to implement, haven't been too successful yet, but I know I'm going to do it in some form is, you know, the overwhelming majority of businesses don't have good control over their contracting. They might have a template they use, but they don't have any control over who changes it. They don't keep good records once it's been signed. You know, it's attached to an email somewhere, or maybe it's in a folder, or maybe they print it out and they stick it in a physical file. But there are systems out there now that are available that will help you manage the creation and the negotiation and the signing and the lifecycle management of a contract. And so I'm looking at contract lifecycle management, contract control and lifecycle management as a business opportunity that I can offer to my clients with platforms that I am subscribed to and aware of or conversant with. And that's a way to embed yourself.
I completely agree with you, Tom, and I've had a problem, so I'm curious to know where you're at with this, because when I talk to those and when I demo those software platforms, they are like, well, we want to sell directly into the business, to their in-house counsel. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, I am their fractional in-house counsel, so I would love a product out there that is catered to me, where I'm the fractional in-house counsel for multiple businesses, and I can, you know, carve out and separate out their contracts all within that same platform. I would love to sign up for one of those platforms. I haven't found it.
You might look at a company out of the Netherlands called We Agree. And I have been a subscriber for a number of years. It's an industrial strength. I mean, this is a platform that is fully capable of handling Fortune 500 level companies. Mm-hmm. And so for little old me, it's a little bit overkill. And there's a steep learning curve, but they do have the feature that if you subscribe as an attorney, you can set up portals for your client. So it has a sophisticated level of access control that was originally developed probably for, you know, different divisions of a corporation and to be managed by in-house counsel. And to be fair, by far the overwhelming majority of their clients are legal departments as opposed to an external law firm. But I've been working with the founder and, you know, we've talked about this exact issue and he's very supportive and very flexible. So it's a company that is well worth looking into from that perspective. Because you're right. There's lots of contract lifecycle management companies, but you say, well, okay, what if I want to have multiple companies? Well, then they each have to get their own licenses and then the relationship is directly with, you know, you're outside of it. You might be the expert,
right?
Now, another analogy for that is, I don't know if you're familiar with the platform called Carta. Carta is the equity management platform for, you know, private companies doing venture rounds. Very sophisticated. I've been working with that with one client for a couple of years now. And Carta, the relationship is with the company, but you can be outside counsel and you can have access so that you're really managing it for them, or you can be the point person. And that's good, but I think even more so if you take a product like We Agree and, you know, talk to Willem, the founder, about it, you could probably get yourself set up as a representative for multiple clients. And then you could set up these portals so that each of your clients would have their own portal and there'd be no overlap, but you would have the benefit. That way, because you're working with a number of different companies, you get more experience, you get farther down the learning curve faster than if you take it to a small company, they'll just be overwhelmed by it.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I found it. It's just weagree.com. So
yeah,
super easy to find. And yep. And this brings us to our technology portion of the show, Tom. So In addition to We Agree, what other technology platforms or software pieces are you using to help you in your practice?
Well, you know, it's pretty basic because it's just me and I don't have a billing system, you know, so I just use QuickBooks, you know, to generate invoices and they all look pretty much the same. Last month, duplicate, change the date, change the month, send it out. Money comes in. You know, it's pretty basic. But some of the things that I have looked at, though, I've looked at a lot of different contract generation platforms. And what I find is that maybe it's because my work is you know, not high volume of a single type of situation, that I find it not cost effective to try to invest the time in creating a contract unless it's, I have a standard that I use and we agree for my operating agreement. And sometimes I use it and sometimes I don't. NDAs, super simple, you know, that's easy, but that's almost a trivial example. So I've found that the, you know, given the size of my practice, which is not huge, and given the staffing level, which is zero, just me, it hasn't been a real benefit to try to get engaged too deeply with contract automation, unless it's coupled with lifecycle and, you know, the larger problem that I just described. I use Lexis. I've used Lexis practice guidance. I've used it on and off. For the longest time, I would get the sales calls and I would hammer them. They'd say, look at all these wonderful forms we have. And I'd say, okay, well, let's look at one. And we download a form. And the first thing, and apologies to Lexis, because I am a subscriber and I've been, you've gone a long way. But, you know, you get this document, not formatted like a contract. It doesn't look like a contract that I would send out to anybody. It says Lexis at the top. It says Lexis at the bottom. So right away, I've got to start taking out footers and headers, reformatting this, reformatting that. None of the numbering is automatic. It's just basically raw words on a page. And I said, you know, if you want to sell this as a value to somebody, you need to make it more usable. And, you know, I'm not just looking for the words. I'm looking for a document that I can, with minimal effort and modification, send to a client. And I can't send them something that looks like this.
Well, Tom, have I got a product for you? This is not meant to be a sponsored segment. In fact, at this point in the episode, my listeners will have already heard the ads for both of these products. But there's a reason that I partner with the sponsors who I partner with, because lawyers like us, I use these products. Otherwise, I wouldn't have them be sponsors of the show. Gavel is formerly Documate, and this is kind of like what you were talking about. It is a bring your own documents. That you automate. You know, if you're doing enough things of this type of thing, like, so for my simple estate plans, this was the no-brainer. This is where I set it up, because it's a link I send to the client, they fill out the information, it automatically creates the document, and it's good to go. And so for certain like contractor agreements, for certain consultant agreements, so I represent some freelancers, some solopreneur consultants, I have like that form contract that I have for them, similar type of thing. Super great. For my business clients, I use 650. 650 is a database and automation platform. Now, unlike Gavel, you can't create your own automations, but they're both subscription products. And so 650's promise to you is like, we're going to keep the documents up to date with new changes in laws. We're going to update the automations over time to improve them. And like for employee handbooks, for all sorts of business agreements and employment type agreements, they have them all in there. It's every jurisdiction in the United States that they have.
Wow.
And listeners know, and Tom, so if you sign up with them, use the code LawSubscribed and you'll get 10% off. You get 10% off. So I use these products, and it is somebody who doesn't bill by the hour. You know, I flat fee my employee handbooks. I've been doing enough of them now that I'm going to start promoting on my website what is the flat fee that I charge for them, because now I know sort of, you know, what I think the value is, because I've done them a few times. And it is, you know, it takes me very little time to actually put something together now, because now I've done it a few times through the platform. I know what their employee handbooks look like based on at least my jurisdictions where I'm representing clients. And I couldn't be happier. And so this is not like a sponsored segment, although they are a sponsor. And listeners know you could save 10% with LawSubscribed. So like definitely check them out.
Well, definitely look at those. Because I've looked at so many of them over the years, and there's always like one piece missing.
They're both started by lawyers, so that helps. Gavel was started by a former Sidley Austin attorney. She's great. She's been on the podcast. And 650 was spun out of Wilson Sonsini, which is
they've been a leader in publishing usable legal resources to the public at large.
Right.
Not seeing that as a threat to their practice, but as an enhancement, as an attraction to their practice.
Right. And so in 650 was probably like, you know, a similar sort of an idea at some point. And then they just, now it's its own totally separate company. But that's where it got started. Reliable.
Yeah, there was a company that existed probably 13, 14 years ago. It was targeting only limited liability company operating agreements. And I think it was called My LLC. And it was some Wall Street lawyers who had friends who were always asking them, hey, can you just like give me an operating agreement? I know I can't pay your rates, but maybe you could just give me the form. And so they said, you know, this is crazy. We've just got to create this website where our friends can go and for a very modest fee, they can get, you know, the benefit of our experience in the, embedded in the form. And I used it quite a bit and then it faded away. I'm not sure why, but those kinds of things come and go.
The domain is active, but it might be different than the one that you were using back in the day.
Yeah, it could be. Well, maybe they've come back. I don't know. But they had a good form.
I never heard of them before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that was the name. I think that was the name.
And it even says on their website that they wrote the book on LLCs and they wrote, they're the authors of the Limited Liability Companies for Dummies book.
Well, maybe it sounds familiar. Maybe they've come back. I might have just lost track of them, but I remember using them and being disappointed when I couldn't find them again. So, I mean,
for what it's worth, the website looks like it hasn't been updated in a long time.
Oh, okay. Okay. Another thing that I used, though, which I like very much, and there's a whole story around this. It actually kept me tied to the Windows ecosystem longer than I should have been until I finally got sick of it and went to Mac. But it's a company called Perfectit. The product is called Perfectit from a company out of the UK called Intelligent Editing. And it's not AI so much as it's just a system of rules. So you put a document into Perfectit and it looks for everything from defined terms not used, defined terms not defined, or capitalized terms not defined, used differently, inconsistency in any number of things. And it also, I wrote an article for one of the law firms I worked for, the last law firm I worked for here in Richmond, and in conjunction with the marketing department, I wrote an article about legal gobbledygook. And I said, you know, you get tired of reading contracts that are full of meaningless phrases and all kinds of stuff. And I had a list of rules, you know, take these all out of your contract. You search and replace, just get rid of them. And the contract will instantly be, you know, twice as readable. And some of those rules, I'm not claiming credit for because I think other people felt the same. Some of those rules are embedded in Perfectit. So for instance, every time you see the words in the event that, just automatically say if. I mean, there's no special meaning to four words as opposed to one. Everybody says it sounds really legal. And I actually had a debate for about 45 minutes with a colleague who is now general counsel to a very large company. And he's a UVA law grad, very accomplished guy. And he was convinced that there was something that was necessary. You had to use that. You couldn't say if. And I finally convinced him. It's just, it's one of those things. And I try to go through all my contracts and I get rid of shall. And I say will, must,
yes,
may, shall is just, I try to put everything in the active voice. I mean, I took a contract that was 12 pages long, just basic services agreement of some sort. And I said, I'm going to try to condense this as much as I possibly can. And I got it down to 3 pages. And I maintain that if you look at the one I started with and the one that I ended up with, there is no functional legal difference. The one is just more verbose code. And, you know, you got to think of
therein, herein,
all that. Yeah. And the analogy that I've made is that, you know, contracts are like code, right? They're like computer code. They're, you know, a list of initial statements, initial conditions, if then statements, you know, whatever, and you come out with a result that hopefully the contract will be a program that will handle any eventuality that you can put into it. It will give you an answer. And the difference is with code, you can run it on a computer and see if it hangs. With a contract, you don't know until you end up in court or some other dispute resolution mechanism. So, but I like the analogy of contracts and code because really it's just the coding language for processing obligations and processing events.
And for like no code tools, so like the tool Gavel that I mentioned, that's how you program your automations in your contracts is using no code if this then that type, you know, setups in the automation. So that's, you know,
right,
it's right there.
Right.
It's right there. And I have found, even though I've never been taught, I'm self-taught on how to use no code tools. It is very much like figuring out a contract, right? If this,
right,
then that, if
yeah,
this, then that, and there you go.
Right.
some of what this perfective that you've mentioned, this tech tool does.
It's perfect it. It's P-E-R-F-E-C-T-I-T. Perfect it. Intelligent editing.
All right. So
very inexpensive, by the way.
Yeah. So this perfect it tool is, it sounds to me like how I've been using generative AI to do some changes, because certainly you can't just, like with generative AI, you could take a document, throw it in, and you could say, change all passive voice to active voice, get rid of all the legalese and replace it with with words that could be used at an eighth grade level. And it will just go through.
Yeah, I've done that too. I think generative AI is probably something of a threat to perfect it unless they incorporate it.
Right.
And I think they probably will. And I haven't touched base with them recently, but I've spoken with the founder and the chief developer. We have a little bit of a conversation going. So maybe they will get to that. But yeah, I mean, generative AI is really interesting. I have been playing around with it. I've subscribed to ChatGPT-4, and that's $20 I ever spent per month, just because, for instance, even such a thing as, I recently closed a transaction for a client selling their business for, well into the eight figures, big number, and dealing with a law firm on the other side, fantastic firm. Happens to be the largest law firm in the world as we speak, I believe. It's called Denton's. Mm-hmm. And I was dealing with an office out of Alabama. It's not their biggest office. They're just part of it. But, I got the Denton's form. Okay. It was like 60 pages long. And at some time, you get halfway through a paragraph and you just have to say, what is this? And I would take a paragraph, throw it into ChatGPT, say, what does this mean? And then read it back and say, yeah, that's what they're trying to say. And it's very good for that kind of thing. It's very good for simplifying. And I've also been a big fan of when you have contracts that involve financial calculations, use formula. If you can't understand it as a mathematical formula, if you can't write it out as a mathematical, expression, then you probably don't understand it. And trying to fill up with words and for the avoidance of doubt and here's an example and but this and but that and notwithstanding the foregoing, man, it's amazing. People don't make more mistakes, but that's something that I've also tried to champion is to say, if you can put it in a formula, put it in a formula. And I'm not saying I did it because I'm sure I didn't, but it's catching on. If you look at the National Venture Capital Association standard forms. And there's an interesting story there too. It has to do with someone who transitioned from the law firm side to the client side. National Venture Capital Association publishes their standard forms for Series A, Series C transactions. And these are everybody will start with those forms, period. And there are some formulas in preferred stock arrangements, weighted average anti-dilution, full ratchet anti-dilution, various things like that, that are best expressed as a formula. And they actually do that, which is great. But the interesting story there is you had a very effective and successful attorney at one of the big Boston firms that does venture, like Ropes & Gray or somebody like that. And they got recruited to be general counsel of a big venture capital fund. I don't remember which one, but like Charles River Associates or somebody like that in Boston. And they started to get these huge legal bills and they realized being on the other side of the table, this is nuts. These people are spending hours debating whose forms they're going to start with. And are we going to use, the rights agreement from this firm or that firm or whatever? And she said basically to the law firm that she was working with, you guys come up with a standard set of forms because we know that they all mean the same thing. You come up with a standard set of forms that you start with or I will not engage you. And voila, all of a sudden, a miracle happened. Everybody got together under the aegis of the National Venture Capital Association, came up with a standard set of starting form. How hard was that, right?
Right.
And so now you don't have associates arguing over, whether we're going to use semicolons here or commas there or whatever. You just get straight to the heart of things. What are the numbers? And do we do this version or that version of a specific clause? And it gets things done much more quickly and efficiently.
Yeah, this is and, called open source. Open source law is like a movement, like one NDA.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good name for it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. One NDA
is another example.
Bond terms. Yeah.
I haven't heard of common paper. I'd like to look at that.
Yeah.
I should maybe spend more time researching some of these things.
I'll send you all the links, Tom, after the show's over.
That's great. Great.
And another thing, as we start to wrap up here, just one more observation is I think ChatGPT, certainly GPT-4, could take words and you could say translate this to an equation and it could probably do it.
It probably could. I haven't tried that yet. Yeah, that's good. Because I've read that ChatGPT-4, people were throwing math equations at it and it was solving them. And then all of a sudden it started giving out gibberish, like something broke. And I don't know, but if you start with words and say, I don't want the answer. I want you to take these words and put them into a mathematical expression. Maybe it could do that. Yeah.
Maybe.
They're finding, I read an article just yesterday that they're finding that these generative AI tools, these large language models, are performing in ways that are totally unexpected. They're actually learning things that they were not expected to have the capacity to learn, and they're improvising. I mean, a large language model, from what I understand, just from reading yesterday, doesn't actually have a memory, right? So it can't put things into memory and then retrieve them for use in another stage of the process. But they're actually finding that some versions of these programs are creating a form of memory in their own, you know, in their own operation that serves that purpose, even though they weren't set up to do that, which is really kind of scary.
makes you wonder, I mean, if human beings are so special after all, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, as a 2001 fan, the first thing I entered into ChatGPT was open the pod bay doors, Hal. And it dutifully replied, I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that.
As an Isaac Asimov fan, I asked it, how do you reverse entropy? If you've ever read the short story, The Last Question by Isaac Asimov.
No, I haven't read that. I should.
I'm going to send that to you too. I'll send that to you as well. So with that, we've run out of time, but I feel like we could keep talking for hours, Tom. So I'm definitely going to have you back in the future.
Great.
But for now, I have to round it out with the same question I ask all my guests, which is part of the reason why I feel like they stick to the end of the show. Is a hot dog a sandwich, and why?
Well, it is, because you've got bread on the top and the bottom, and you've got something in between. But it never occurred to me that it wasn't a sandwich. It's just it's sui generis in a sense, but at the same time, it obviously is well within the definition of a sandwich, as I would define it.
Second time we've heard sui generis in response to this question.
Well, that's interesting. Of course, then the question is a Big Mac a sandwich? And having worked at McDonald's before I went to law school, the last summer that I between my junior and senior years, I worked at McDonald's, and I can tell you that it is a sandwich because it's two all beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions, and a sesame seed bun. So, by definition.
There you go. If people wanted to follow up with you and get in touch, what's the best way for them to do that?
Just send me an email at tom@timelesscounsel.com.
Simple.
I'll be excellent. Happy to respond.
And on LinkedIn too.
Look forward to it. Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn. I guess you just look for Thomas Bowden on LinkedIn. I'm sometime back active in that alternative field lawyers group, and I'm not even sure what groups I'm in anymore, but I definitely like to get into it there.
All right, great. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. I'm glad we could do this.
And that's our show. Thanks again to 650 and Gavel for being sponsors. The best way for others to discover this show is for you to share it with somebody you think would find value from it. Follow me on LinkedIn, since that's where I'm most active on social media, and click the bell towards the top right of my profile to get notified about all of my posts about this podcast and everything else I think is valuable for you to see. To get in touch, message me on LinkedIn or email kurbis@lawsubscribed.com. All links are in the show notes. Until next time, this is Matthew Kurbis with Law Subscribed.